What's up, Chiefs Kingdom? You're on another episode of Chiefs Focus Live. We got a special guest, Mr. Man, Joe Valerio. What's up, buddy?
Oh, JP, Caleb, Quentin, great to see you guys. Thanks for having me on. Great to connect with Chiefs Kingdom. And, you know, even though this offseason is the offseason, the Chiefs give us plenty to talk about, don't they?
Man.
They do indeed.
You can't avoid the kingdom. I mean, it's crazy. Everything that's going on with this team, and now that, you know, the whole D-Hop talk and then going to the president, you know, seeing the president and doing everything that they've done here recently has been great. Scott said, welcome, Joe. Scott's one of our longtime listeners. Man, you played back in the day when I was around that team a lot. You were.
Yeah. Time flies when you're having fun. I mean, I can't believe, you know, I'm watching the draft this year and you know, it was 32 years since I was drafted back in 1991. And I don't know where the time goes, but, you know, obviously it leaves you with a lot of great memories. And, you know, Chiefs Kingdom was amazing. And I always say, and not just because we're talking and, you know, we're getting here in front of Chiefs Kingdom, but if my wife and I didn't grow up literally 10 minutes from each other and we went to high school together, we had triplets in tow when we left Kansas City, we absolutely would have stayed in Kansas City. Like it was a dream place to live, you know, to be a part of the Chiefs family. And, you know, there was just a lot of factors that brought us back to Philadelphia. But I'll tell you, they were six of the best years of our lives. And my wife taught school out there. She was teaching elementary school in Blue Valley School District in Overland Park. And we, you know, I was doing the stuff with Lenny the Cool on Channel 9. I was filling in for him.
That's right.
Doing the 6 and the 10 fill-in anchor spots. We had the radio show on KCFX. I mean, we had an awesome thing going. And I really do appreciate the support of all the Kansas City fans and the people of Kansas City. It was an amazing, amazing community to be a part of.
Yeah, it's you know, it's crazy to think about all those times back in the day. We had Tim on a while back, Tim Grunhart, and I've known Tim forever, and we just started talking about the old times with Dave Craig and, you know, everybody that was on the team at the time and the stuff, some of the stuff that we had seen, and, you know, just. We talked about the first time I'd ever seen Christian Okoye, you know, come out on the practice field, and I didn't know it was him. And I was sitting next to Derek and I said, who the hell is that?
Yeah.
And he said, that's Christian. And I said, ain't the guy that ran the 4.58. He said, yeah, it is.
Think about it. JP, think about it. I came out of the Ivy League, right? So I played at Penn.
Yeah.
And Christian Okoye was bigger than any defensive player that I ever blocked in college. And he was our tailback at 6, you know, 3, you know, 265, 270 pounds. So think about that. Think about my perspective of like, wait a minute, give me the ball and let me run behind him. I got to block for this guy. Like, wait a minute. No, he should be blocking for me.
Exactly.
That was a big step up for me. And I'll tell you, you know, speaking of Tim, what an amazing mentor he was for me. I mean, if it weren't for guys like Tim and Dave Zott and all the great guys who were paving the way before, I mean, I know I wouldn't have lasted as long as I did. They just were great mentors. They brought, you know, they brought the rookies along. It was an incredibly encouraging and just an environment that was supportive of each other. And, you know, Marty had set a culture and the Hunt family had set a culture, you know, along obviously with Carl Peterson of camaraderie and being all in the boat together, rowing in the same direction. And I just, you know, I can't say enough good things about Tim and what he did for me in my career and his friendship and what he's also and staying in the community, right? And being part of the fabric of Kansas City. He's an amazing person and he's got a wonderful family, and it's been such a pleasure staying in touch with him over the years and, you know, being teammates for life with that guy.
Yeah, he just wrote a book, actually.
It was fantastic. I had a chance to write a blurb about it and worked with his editors a little bit on it. And
awesome.
He's just an amazing guy. And the book is amazing. And, you know, Christian's got a book coming out as well.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And so I'll get to add a little bit to that, because he was one of those guys that just was another special team. I mean, I know that this team today is amazing, and I do, and not just because I played in that era, but I really do feel like the Carl Peterson, Marty Schottenheimer era really did set the foundation for the rebuilding of Chiefs Kingdom. And, you know, not just because I was a part of it, sounds like I'm bragging about it, but, you know, I just think that that winning attitude, it just brought out the best in the community, the fan base. And I think it just set this organization on a path that was brought it back to, you know, the glories of the Len Dawson and Otis Taylor and Ed Buddy days. And, you know, it could go on and on and on about all those guys.
Yeah.
I just think it was really a great group of guys who had really set the stage, I think, for the success that you see today. And I've seen since then, right, all through, you know, the Dick Vermeil era and then the Haley era and everything that's gone after. It was been a really nice run for Kansas City, for sure.
Definitely has. Yeah, it was a good time back then. I tell these guys all the time, because I'm the oldest one out of pretty much everybody. I think I double both, you know, I'm twice their both their ages combined. But Marty was a different guy, and I used to tell people all the time he was such a motivator, and he did it in a way that he had me wanting to run through a brick wall, and I didn't play football. I mean, I played baseball, but he was just that guy that you could feel yourself floating across the field at practice when he was telling, you know, when he'd have one of his little talks with somebody, or he would, you know, he was so philosophical about everything that he did. You know, he always had a way of making you feel good no matter what you did. If you were doing something wrong, he still made you feel good. Yeah. Marty just brought a different culture and a different mindset to things. And he was such a great guy. I mean, he allowed me to hang out when I was just friends with people. I wasn't anybody special. You know, I mean, I was just friends with Derek and friends with JJ and a few other guys. And he let me hang out on the field, let me go to the games, and I got to hang out and have fun. You know, I mean, it was probably the best time of my life. But
That's great to hear. Yeah, he was, Marty was the kind of coach that the thing I respected the most about Coach was that he treated everybody the way they needed to be treated. He didn't try to jam square pegs into round holes. You know, he treated you the way that you needed to be motivated, and he knew how everybody's motivation and incentives worked, and he treated everybody differently, which sounds unique, because you're like, well, or sounds odd because you're like, well, on a team, don't you want to treat everybody the same? And that's not always the case when you want to build chemistry. You have to understand how to coach certain players, and he knew how to motivate people the way that they personally need to be motivated. And I really appreciated that about him, because it showed that he took the time to get to know you, and he didn't just try to broad brush his motivation or broad brush his coaching style to meet everybody else. And I think that's something that I think Andy Reid does exceptionally well. Marty was very similar. You know, I think he showed his flexibility in moving away from Marty Ball into the West Coast offense when, you know, they talked him into bringing Joe Montana in and bringing in Paul Hackett as offensive coordinator. And, you know, that was a big diversion for Marty. You know, he had built his career on Marty Ball, right? Yep. And it was Big Max, Ernest Biner with the Browns. It was, you know, Christian and Barry Word with the Chiefs and big fullbacks. And, you know, he pivoted, man. And I think that's what, you know, Andy Reid probably has learned from a lot of coaches. That the thing that I respect the most about Andy Reid is that he builds his playbook around his players, and he builds his players around his playbook, and he meets them right, everything in the middle, which he doesn't, again, using that analogy, he doesn't just take square pegs and jam them into a round hole and say, well, you know what, this is my offensive philosophy and you're going to fit it. Like, he doesn't do that. He sees the players' skills, their abilities, their strengths, their weaknesses. He tweaks the playbook to meet that, but he also is able to take a playbook and match it to his players, as well as matching his players to a playbook. And I think that's the secret sauce of why there's been this sustained success. Even when he was in Philadelphia, he did the same things when he was in Philadelphia. You know, I mean, the fans booed him when he drafted Donovan McNabb, you know, and I think people were like, oh, you know, how's he going to get this guy? You know, Donovan had a great career at Syracuse, but I don't think a lot of people thought he was going to translate to the NFL game. But, you know, he goes to NFC Championship. They go to a Super Bowl. He has multiple winning seasons, championship, you know, NFC East Championship. So he just has started – he started doing that when he was in Philadelphia as a younger coach. And then I think he's kind of continued to hone that skill of really getting to know his players, their talents, and making his playbook work for them and making the players work for the playbook.
We've made that analogy before about what, in fact, JJ and I had, he comes on the show a couple times a year, and we had talked about how Marty and Andy are similar in so many ways. And, you know, what you're saying about treating players differently, and he knows everybody, he knew everybody's personalities. And that was something that is kind of unheard of when it comes to a head coach in the NFL. Most head coaches, it's, like you said, it's my way or the highway type of thing. If you don't like it, too bad. This is how you're going to do it. Christian was a great example of that. I mean, I watched Christian get so upset in practice, you know, especially the time he ran over JJ. That was scared the hell out of me. But he, you know, Christian, he flat out said he hated football. You know, he hated it because he wasn't the guy that wanted to really hurt people. He didn't enjoy hurting people. He didn't understand it that well when he first got, especially to the Chiefs. And Marty made he didn't make him understand it. He helped him understand it. And he just knew how to motivate people in their own specific ways. And I thought that was great. You know, I mean, I loved Marty. He was a great guy. So
Christian didn't just hurt defensive players. He also hurt offensive players too.
Absolutely.
we used to wear Christian pads on our triceps because when he would get going downhill, he didn't care if he had a red jersey on, a blue jersey, whatever. He was running you over. Like he had his one cut, and then once he made his cut, he was going downhill. Man, I can't tell you how many times I got lambasted in the back by Christian, like coming and just busting through a hole, and he took the whole pile with him. He was amazing at just getting his forward momentum going. So yeah, he was quite the spectacle. And I mean, I don't know. Caleb and Quentin, I don't know if you guys are Tecmo Bowl fans or if you've ever seen some of the YouTube videos of him. I know JP probably has, where, like, you know, he would just – if you got to be the Chiefs with Christian and Tecmo Bowl, I guess it was on the Nintendo game system.
Yeah, it was Nintendo 64, if I remember right.
You were winning because just – Christian would just start running and rampaging over everybody, and he would just, you know – you could run him around the field. It's kind of like Bo Jackson was the same way on mobile. But Christian was a special guy, and I think he's also been another guy that's really stayed close to the community and done some great things after football.
Yeah, we talked about Christian in that time. He got really upset. Marty was teaching him the handoff. You know, take the ball, cradle it, take off. You know, make your cut, do what you need to do. And he kept dropping the ball. It was when he first got there. And he'd get really upset and couldn't grasp it. And he pulled him off to the side and he said, "Chris, what I want you to do is when you get the ball in your hand, I just want you to run over anybody that's in front of you." "Okay, coach." Man, he took off and JJ was running protection and he laid JJ out. And I mean, it was like a cartoon. I mean, it was like an indention in the field. And JJ was just laid out like this, you know, and I jumped off the bench because I thought he was dead. I was just sitting there watching, you know, and it was like, "Oh my God, he's dead." And his eyes were wide open and he wasn't moving for a minute. And they finally got him up and he said, "What happened?" And Christian's all upset. He was actually kind of teared up a little bit because he thought he killed him. And he said, "Man, I hate this game. I hate this game." And JJ said, "Chris, it's okay. But you know, look, look at my jersey. Don't run me over, run everybody else over, you know?" I mean, he was so upset. Needless to say, neither one of them practiced the rest of the day. But that was the day that I knew he was special. I mean, that guy was special. So strong, man. He was so strong. He was just he was like an Adonis. I mean, just built like nobody's business. When he ran out on that field, I told Derek. I said, "There's no way he's the guy that ran that 4.58." And he goes, "He absolutely does. Watch when he takes off running." And he did. And I went, "Oh my God, I would be scared." I mean, if he was coming towards me, I would just move. I wouldn't even think about it. I'd just move. I'd just say, "You know what? I'm done. I don't even want to be near this." Sure. Yeah. So I know these guys got some questions for you, especially Quentin.
Yeah.
He's been dying. Yeah. Okay. So
come on, let's do it.
Caught 4 touchdown passes in your career as an offensive lineman in the 90s. That wasn't, I mean, even now it's rare to see the big man catching the football. How did you become the guy to catch the ball near the goal line.
It's actually a really good story. So I was always the extra tight end. So even before Joe Montana came to Kansas City, I was always the third tight end who would come in on what we call tank formation, right? Short yardage and goal line. You know, it was me, Jonathan Hayes, because we didn't really carry a whole lot of tight ends back then. You know, Troy
Sedow. Yeah, Keith Cash too, I think, at the time.
Keith Cash, but he was more of like an H-back, so yeah. they needed the extra beef to come in. So I would come in and be the extra lineman, you know, tight end, report eligible. And I did that even in the early 90s before Joe Montana got there and Paul Hackett came. But I never literally it was come in, block. We barely threw the ball out in the open field on third down, let alone around the goal line. So Joe Montana comes in 1993 and Paul Hackett starts, you know, installing the short yardage and goal line. And you know, he says, hey, Joe, I know you've played, you know, tight end in the past in short yardage and goal line. You know, we're going to continue to use you in that position because, again, the West Coast offense wasn't a big tight end offense either. Right. So it was, you know, guys like Keith Cash and Tracy Green. We had Derek Walker. I mean, they were big guys, but they weren't lineman types. Right. So they wanted to keep that same motif of having, you know, a big lineman come in. So one day they decided they were going to put in a play where I went into about 5 yards into the end zone, 3 yards into the end zone. And I was a total dummy decoy. Like nobody, the play was not intended for the ball to be thrown at all. And there was a crossing pattern. I was like, you know, Kimball Anders, you know, he goes out into the flat. Keith Cash crosses one way coming from the H-back. And then like Derek Walker crosses the other way or one of the wide receivers who might've been in that position. And I was basically there as a screen to kind of pick off any linebackers who might be, if they were in man coverage, or to just take up a spot in the zone if they decided to play zone down in the goal line. And one day Joe Montana thinks he's going to have a little bit of fun with me. And he's, you know, I mean, we ran this play in training camp a bunch of times, you know, and nobody ever even looked at me to throw me the ball. And one day we're at practice and Joe gets it into his head that he's going to like make a fool out of me and he's going to dunk the ball at me and hit me with it either in the stomach or in the face mask. And he fires the ball at me after I had like pointed to like Keith Cash and JJ. I'm like, no, throw it over there. And so he's staring at me and, you know, Joe had he didn't have like a rocket arm like John Elway or, you know, Peyton Manning, right? But he still had a pretty decent arm, right, for NFL quarterback, even at his advanced age at that point. And he fired that thing at me. And I don't think he knew that I had played basketball in high school. And I was also a catcher. And I actually didn't think I was even going to play football in college. I thought I was going to play baseball in college. I was recruited to play catcher in college. And so I stuck my hands up and I caught it. And, you know, he was like, what just happened? Paul Hackett, throws his clipboard up in the air and he comes running over. He's like, dude, you can catch. I'm like, I don't know. I haven't touched one of these things since, you know, I don't know, eighth grade or whatever, other than, you know, picking up a fumble or long snapping or playing center. And so Paul Hackett says, hey, Joe, he goes, you're going to catch a touchdown this year. And I was like, dude, Coach Hackett, like this West Coast offense really opens things up if, you know, guys like me, like I became the wide receiver, right? So he decides to put the play in and we're playing the Raiders. And, you know, the thing about it was, you know, Joe Montana's confidence level in his players, like, you know, we had repped a lot and he had thrown, I would go out and catch, you know, I would work out with the tight ends occasionally. And the guy starts to just develop a confidence in you. And when we called that play for the first time against the Raiders in 1992 or 93, like Joe didn't panic. Like he didn't ask me like 20 questions in the huddle. Like, you know, are you going to catch this? Are your shoes tied? Are your gloves tight? Are your pads all strapped on right? Like he wasn't worried. He literally, even though I was, you know, 197 touchdowns short of Jerry Rice, he treated me like I was Jerry Rice. And he just was like, hey, you know, fake 16, George, you slam on two, let's go, break, boom, and we're off. And, you know, it's fourth and one, and he doesn't have any problem with it. Like, you know, and it just was, it just kind of built on it from there. And, you know, the thing that was really cool about those touchdowns is every one of them was in a really, really cool game. Like, the first one was against the Raiders, right? Who doesn't, what chief doesn't want to score against the Raiders, right? Yep. And so, like, you know, it's Marty Schottenheimer Raider week, the whole mystique around all that. So, you know, I open up with the Raiders, you know, and today, to this day, I have a I have an electric football. I'm a big electric football fan. So I have an electric football set with the roster of or the lineup of all the players from the Raiders Chiefs. And I put the numbers on.
That's
I
cool.
got all the positions and I have, so I have that. So the Raiders was great, but then you fast forward to 1994 and all of a sudden it's, you know, it's the Joe Montana, you know, Steve Young game of the year. Right. I mean, this is it. Right. They've been waiting for this game ever since Joe joined the Chiefs for us.
God, to play. I can't remember. I'll never forget that game.
You know, September 11th, 1994. And, you know, we put in the play and, you know, JJ gets tackled on like the, I want to say it was like the 3 yard line. And JJ, we always joked about that. He's like, man, Joe, you're so lucky I didn't get in on that play because he was about to score and he got like shoestring tackled. And we run, you know, we run the play and it's the first touchdown of the game. It's a beautiful sunny Sunday. And I'm scoring, you know, a Joe Montana ball against and it helps us beat the 49ers who like basically dismissed him. And, you know, he had that crazy relationship with Steve Young. And it's like, what just happened? Like, did that really happen? And crazily, both of my parents were at that game and at the 49ers game as well. And then you get to the Monday night game, right? The Elway shootout in 1994 gets rated as like one of the best Monday night games of all time. And, you know, in the third quarter, you know, I scored. Now that one was not a designated play. I was like the fifth receiver on that play. It just happened to be that Kimball fell out of the backfield. Keith Cash got held up at the line, and Derek Walker, just as Joe was looking at him, ran right in front of the umpire. So Joe lost sight of him, and he panicked. And he looked at me, and I was standing out in space, and I was 4 yards from the goal line, and he throws me a perfect strike. And I had to actually over my shoulder. And I – you know, embarrassingly, I panicked and I dove in from the 4 yard line. Jim remembers that.
I kind of remember that.
Because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do with the ball. I was like, I was afraid I was going to get hit. I didn't know where any, I had no field awareness, right? As a lineman, I'm used to operating in a 7 foot box, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I dive in and oh my God, it was so crazy. And then of course the Cardinals game where I scored, that was also the same game with the Steve Bono crazy 76 yard touchdown run, right? Which for the longest time was the longest run by a quarterback in NFL history. He was supposed to throw me the ball, but Buddy Ryan sent all 11 guys in to tackle Marcus. And I think he threw a couple of referees and some fans in there too. And Steve just started running, and I started sprinting, and I was beating him in a foot race, and he's yelling at me. He's like, Joe, stop. You're beating me in the race. He's like, I can't let a lineman. He's like huffing and puffing. He's like, I can't let a lineman beat me. And so I like turned around, and I started running backwards, which I think embarrassed him a little bit more. Beating him. So, you know, we still laugh about that when I talk to Steve. And then I ended up scoring later in that game. And the reason that game was really special was that, you know, that was where we were knock on wood. We were supposed to have gone to play in the Super Bowl, right? Like that was supposed to be the Super Bowl was in Arizona that year. And we were kind of thinking, you know, this is where we were going to meet the Cowboys. And, you know, unfortunately it didn't work out. But, yeah, so they were four really, really special plays and games, and it was really fun to, you know, to hear myself call for something other than, you know, 73 holding, you know, 73 face pass. It was really nice to actually hear my name called for doing something good. But we you know, we had a lot of fun with it. I treated a lot of dinners. It cost me a lot of fines in our fine board in the offensive line room. You know, I had to take the quarterbacks and the linemen out every time I scored one. So I don't think I made much money those weeks. it was a lot of fun. And thanks for asking about that.
Yeah, well, you had 100%, you know, catch percentage. So, you know, you got hands.
Listen, I was Chris Carter before Chris Carter was Chris Carter.
There we go.
You only score touchdowns, baby. So, you know, but yeah, I had two kickoff returns too. I was multi talented. You know, I had two kickoff returns for 15 yards. I was one of the tight ends on kickoff return, and twice they fired the ball right at me, hoping I'd fumble it. But so I gained 15 yards on kickoff returns. I was no Tamarack Vanover or Dante Hall or anything, but I do have some returns under my belt as well. But you know, a lot of fun memories. And
well, your agility numbers were high. That's what your combine agility numbers were very high, and that was pretty amazing for somebody on the offensive line to have agility numbers as high as your. I think you were at 81.
Yeah, well, that was just, you know, that was that's a testament to, I think, playing multiple sports. Yeah. You know, through high school, you know, I actually one year I played four sports during the school year. I actually threw the shot put in winter track while I was playing basketball. And I would play basketball all week, and then on Saturday mornings I would go throw the shot put in indoor meets. And then I was doing basketball. I wrestled up until 10th grade. I played baseball my whole life. I thought baseball, like I said, was what I was going to do in college. So, you know, yeah, I think it was that. And, you know, and I had to do something coming out of the Ivy League. You know, I mean, it was an interesting transition. You know, I was blocking Biff McNutty from Harvard, and then I was going against Howie Long and Reggie White. Like, you know,
yeah, that's fair.
So I had to do something, and I felt like, you know, my athletic ability was hoping would help me, you know, propel me into the next level, and trying to be sort of a new breed of lineman that could be a little bit more agile. I had to, right? Because I didn't have, you know, the right competition. I mean, I remember Neil Smith. One time Penn had a really good basketball team in 1994, and they actually had two guys that played in the NBA. They had Matt Maloney, who played for years. He used to feed Charles Barkley with the Suns, and we had Jerome Allen, who had a long NBA and international career. And I knew that they were a really loaded team, even for the Ivy League. And just because they were in the Ivy League, we saw what Princeton did this year, right? Is what, yep. Like a 15 seed, yeah, or 14, yep, or whatever. The Ivy League always gets low. They always get those low seeds because of the competition. And, but I knew this team had it. And Penn that year, I believe they got an 11 seed, and Nebraska got a 6 seed. So Neil Smith was feeling really confident. He's like, hey, he comes up to me. He called me little buddy. So he goes, hey, little buddy. He goes, I hear we're playing each other in the tournament this year in March Madness. I said, yeah. He goes, you want to pull a little money on it? Absolutely. I said, about $100. He goes, all right, $100. You're feeling pretty good. I said, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. And he goes, you guys are an 11 seed. I said, yeah, I know. And he goes, well, Nebraska's a 6 seed. I said, it's okay. I'm good. And so Penn goes and wins that game. So he comes into the locker room on Monday for workouts. We're down at the workout facility in the off-season workout program. And he goes, hey, little buddy. He goes, here, first of all, here's your $100. And he goes, second of all, what the hell's a Quaker?
That sounds like Neil.
Give me what's a Quaker. I said, it's the guy on the oatmeal box, you know, Quaker Oats. I said, they're a peace-loving, you know, settlers in the Philadelphia area, you know, back in the 1600s. And he goes, I thought you went to Penn State. And I said, no, Neil, I went to the University of Pennsylvania. I didn't go to Penn State. I said, I would have liked to play for Joe Paterno, but I didn't. And so, yeah, we laughed about that for a really long time. But, yeah, so it was an interesting transition coming out of the Ivy League. And Tim and I still joke about that, because he swears to this day that I said that in my opening interview, I got interviewed by Conrad Dobler right after the draft at Lynn Dickey's Sports Bar in Westport.
Yep.
And you know, I was, look, I wanted to at least show some confidence, right? And during the interview, I had said, well, listen, Conrad, he goes, because Conrad basically asked me, he's like, do you think you can play at this level, having gone to the University of Pennsylvania? And I said, well, I said, I think I can hold my own. I said, in the East-West Shrine Game, I got to play against guys from Penn State, Notre Dame, and Michigan, and Oklahoma. And I said, I think I can do it. I held my own, and I think I'll be okay. It's going to take me some time to transition. So Timmy, to this day, he and Dave Zott, to this day, still swear that I said that Penn could have beaten Penn State and Notre Dame in football.
Oh.
You know, Tim, you took it completely out of context. Completely out of context. I said Penn State and Notre Dame would have beaten Penn 100-0 if we played each other. I said, stop with this shenanigans. But yeah, so we still laugh about that. He still swears that I said that Penn could have beaten Penn State and Notre Dame in football. But anyway, it's 30 plus years later, and he still thinks I would say something like that.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like something Neil would do. Neil was he was funny. Neil was a funny guy. People didn't realize how funny he actually was, but he was almost a prankster to a degree. You know, he would
oh god, he used to throw those smell bombs. He used to break those smell bombs and he would break. Throw him in the trash can right as he was leaving the meeting room, and Marty used to get really mad. One of my favorite Neil stories was he loved to play trick. So we're going over the dress code. Okay, so Marty was a stickler on the rules and the dress code, and at the beginning of every training camp, he would always go through the 10 major rules that we had. You know, curfew. You know, blah, blah, blah. You got to do this. And he said, on the plane, when we travel, you have to wear, you can't wear shorts and you have to wear a collared shirt. Right. So everybody's like, all right, whatever. Like most of the linemen wore polo shirts and jeans, right? Cause we're linemen. We don't know what we're doing. Right. So fashion wise or whatever. But Neil wanted to play a trick on Marty. So he says to Marty in the meeting, he says, well, coach, he says, right now, there's this whole fashion statement. It's called a bandit collar, and it's like a dress shirt, but it doesn't have flaps on it. He goes, is that considered a collared shirt? Can we wear those? And Marty's like, what are you talking about? Like, what's it? So then he starts this whole hullabaloo, and everyone's like, oh, man, we can't wear bandit collar shirts. Oh, and everybody's yelling, and like Marty's like, stop it. I don't even know where these shirts is. So, Neil did it just to get a rise out of Coach Schottenheimer. So he really was. He was a lot. I mean, Neil was literally one of my favorite people in the earth. I mean, he was such a fun guy.
Yeah, he was a blast to be around. I mean, he did some crazy stuff. I mean, like you said, I mean, the stink bombs. He lived at Spencer's. It was like he loved Spencer's. Yeah. And he would go there purposely. He would buy cans of fart spray.
Yep.
And you know what I'm talking about? The cans of, like, I don't know if you guys know, but I know Joe would know. They sell cans of fart spray, and it's just such a rank smell. But he would spray that stuff on your back as you're walking by.
It'd be a problem.
Just a hot shot like that. And then, you go on by, and people are like, what the hell's wrong? It's coming off this guy. And he'd be in the back laughing because he just thought it was funny, you know? Yeah. That was just Neil, man. He did some crazy stuff.
But, unbelievable player, great human being. I mean, like I said, one of the best people I ever met. He and Derek, the charitable stuff that they used to do and the generosity that they showed in the Kansas City community were absolutely amazing. I mean, they used to dress up as Santa during the holidays. And I mean, they weren't just, these guys weren't just, doing it for show. They really did it for real. And they made a lot of people's Christmases and they were almost generous to a fault. And
well, we talk about Derek all the time about that. He was so concerned with everybody else. It was unheard of. I mean, people used to say certain things about him, about his kids and this and that and the other, but I got to tell you, I mean, I know his kids and they all, not one of them has ever said, my dad was not there. You know, I mean, he did everything for everybody all the time. It didn't matter who it was. In fact, I'll tell you, we went to lunch one day and we were driving along in his convertible Mercedes, and he had his Alabama hat on. And I said, next time you go down there, give me one of those hats. I like that hat. Okay. We got back to his house. He goes into the kitchen. First, he turns on Bruce Lee, which that was his favorite thing, because, you know, that was his whole thing behind, that was his workout, was Bruce Lee, his technique workout, you know. And he turns on Bruce Lee and he walks into the kitchen and he comes back out and he throws me this hat, and he didn't have a hat on. And I said, "You had another one?" He goes, "No, that's mine." And I said, "What?" He goes, "That's the first one I ever got at Alabama." No. And I said, "You got to be kidding me." I said, "You don't have to give me that." Well, here it is. And he signed it in a pen, signed it with a pen. I mean, you can barely see it, but
that's beautiful.
I mean, it's old. I mean, it's still got his sweat marks in it, but that's the first hat he ever got from.
That's from awesome, JP.
Yeah. He's such a nice guy, man. We were there. We were talking about it. We were there one day. It was New Year's Eve. And these Boy Scouts come knocking on the door. And they didn't know it was his house. And I live four doors from him. That's how we actually realized it in the locker room one day. But I was there and he knocked on the door and he opened the door and they were like, "Oh my God, this is Derek Thomas." You know, they didn't know what to do. And they were just like stuttering. They were flipped out. And they were collecting, you know, collecting for the Boy Scouts or whatever they were doing. And he said, "JP, you got any money?" I said, "Yeah." "Why?" He goes, "Well, I don't have any cash on me." I said, "Well, all I got is $100 bills." He goes, "Okay, that'll do."
Yeah, there you go.
So I pulled out a $100 bill and he goes, "Here you go, kids. Have a good day." I mean, he was such a nice guy. I mean, he says, "I'll pay you back." I said, "Don't worry about it, man. You do enough for people. I'm good." I said, "I don't need the $100, you know, that bad." And he said, "Oh, yeah. I'm going to give it back to you." And one day, it's out of nowhere, he comes up to me and he goes, "Oh, by the way, here you go." And it was this little tiny, like, it was like a, oh, like one of those little tiny gift cards that you see on like a thing of flowers. And I thought, "What the hell is this?" I open it up. It's a $100 bill all folded up in there. I said, "I don't want this." But that was just Derek, man. I mean, that was just how he was. He was a good, we had his oldest son on a while back.
Oh, that's awesome. Darius. If you think those kids were surprised when they saw him, imagine my eyes were when I had to go against him one-on-one. He was my first one-on-one pass protection as a professional athlete, as a professional player, and live, because we did some stuff at mini camp, but it was nothing live like training camp. And he lined up, and John Ault, who was our starting left tackle, obviously he held out of camp, and then Derek Graham, who was our backup left tackle, was hurt. So I go into training camp as the air quote starting left tackle, like I'm the starting left tackle as a rookie from Penn, right? So I got to go against him every day, and that first one-on-one pass protection I went against him in training camp, you know, I said to myself, "All right, well, I'm going to try to use my Penn education here," and I started pulling out like scientific equations, and I was like, "All right, like force equals mass times acceleration." I'm like, "All right, so I've got the mass," because I was bigger than Derek. I had the F part of the equation. Then I went to the A part of the equation and I was like, he's kind of got me on that. You know, I'm running, they clock me on a calendar when I run the 40 and they clock him on a stopwatch. And so I said to myself, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use my mass and I'm going to go out and just attack him and get on top of him and keep him from using his speed. Well, when he saw my feet come together, because when you hustle out there too fast and you don't use the right technique and you lose your base, my feet came together and he saw that happen and he turned on a dime, and he ran 2 feet through me. He just didn't run over me. He like walked over my chest, knocked me down. He tapped the dummy quarterback that we had, you know, back there at 7 yards during the one-on-one pass protection. And, you know, he put his hand out, lifted me up and said, "Welcome to the NFL, Rook." But what he did, though, over the course of that training camp is every time I would go against him, he'd say what I did well and what I could do better. And he was like having a coach on the field. And again, he's another one of those guys like Grunny. If not for Derek Thomas and that rookie, I don't think I would have made it 2 years in the NFL. Because he was the guy that every day was like, "Joey V," you know, that's what he called me, Joey V. He's like, "Joey V, you got it, man. That right hand, you really did a good job and you locked me out." He goes, "Keep doing that." Or, "Hey, you know, make sure you drag your left foot. You know, you're kicking it back too slow," or whatever. He always had something positive to say and coach to try to make his teammates better. And that's what I really loved about Derek, as being an unbelievable human being, as a football player and a leader. He was the guy that was always out there trying to make his teammates better, but in a constructive, positive way. Not that he not be, not to show you he was the best, but to help you become better. And I really respected him for that. And he was inclusive. He was all inclusive. Mm-hmm. You know, he invited every guy on the team to his birthday party, and, you know, Hank Williams Jr.'s there and all these celebrities and people hanging out. And it just was like everybody treated him like he was just Derek from the neighborhood. And I just, the guy was amazing, 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 amazing. You know, every time he'd see, you know, a spouse or a significant other, he'd greet them by name. And, you know, he knew my wife Jennifer's name, and he'd always ask her how she was doing when he'd see her out at dinner or at a party or something. And he was really, really special person.
I used to tell these guys about his technique and how his mindset was, because he always used to tell me, you don't have to be the biggest, you don't have to be the strongest, you have to have the best technique. And that's what his mindset was when he played the game. And people, you know, a lot of times if you don't know football, you don't understand what that means. But his technique was unparalleled because of the way he was able to hone in on it. He honed in on the technique more than he did the strength and the power and the, you know, everything else. He did. In fact, I mean, a lot of people called him lazy because he didn't want to work out all the time. You know, it was one of those things he didn't specifically like to do, was sit in the gym for 8 hours a day. And I asked him one time at his house, I said, you know, how come you don't work out a lot? He goes, why, do you think I need to? And I said, no, not what I'm saying. I said, do you think you might be a little bit, you know, I mean, you're already great, but do you think it would help your game at all? And he said, you know, I tried that down at Alabama. He said, I worked out 4 days a week, and come Saturday, I was so stiff, I didn't feel like I could play as well.
Yeah.
He said, so I slowed down on the working out. I still do the cardio. I still do all that. I do some weights. But he said, when it comes down to it, he said, I'm better when I'm flexible, and I can make the moves that I need to make. And that's what, I think that's what made him, that and his determination to just be
The best. He was a perfectionist when it came to
He really was. And,
you know, he was a tactician, and he was like a surgeon. You know, he was very successful with his moves, and you know, it was amazing, you know, getting to go against him, you know, every day. He definitely made anybody he went against better, and in a really good way. Not that he was going to try to show you up. He just wanted to make you better so that, you know, when you were, if you could block him decently in practice, there wasn't really anybody else, you know. You know, he and John used to get into some great battles, and that's why John was so good. And there was nobody that John couldn't block if he could handle Derek Thomas. So yeah, it was really really special, you know, having him around.
Yeah, what do you guys got? I know Quentin's got some questions.
Oh yeah,
I got one.
Go ahead, Quentin.
just kind of looking at the NFL, obviously you had a good career and we've seen how things progress and change. What would you think is kind of the biggest change you see from back then when you played in the 90s versus today? Like, what do you think is like the biggest change that has completely made football what it is today compared to back then?
Two positions, Caleb. Great question. Two positions, the tight end position and the defensive tackle position.
Okay.
I think those are, because if you look at the game really, at most of the positions, hasn't really changed, right? I mean, you look at your successful quarterbacks, you know, they all have strong arms. So I would probably throw quarterback in at the third as the third, but definitely far behind, because I think, you know, while Patrick Mahomes is magical in what he does with his body, he's still a quarterback. And I think he because he's got a great arm, he's got great field vision, he's got happy feet. And you know, he's not a whole lot different than what Joe Montana was like, or, you know, a John Elway, you know, somebody who could move around the pocket and, you know, gain some yards if he had to, or, and throw strikes where they had to. But so everybody kind of like focuses on the quarterback position, but for me, it's the evolution of the tight end position and what that has done for the game of football. Because, you know, when you go back to the 80s, 90s, and, you know, even to a certain degree, the early 2000s, you know, tight ends were really an extension of the offensive line. Yeah, you had some guys who could get out and catch. And we had them. You know, we had them. Derek Walker and Keith Cash was more of an H-back. Jonathan Hayes in those early years of the Chiefs was a big, he was like an extension of the line. He didn't have a, he wasn't a huge pass threat. Could you hit him over the middle? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think the ability to have like almost like a fifth wide receiver out there, or technically like a fourth wide receiver, if you're running a three wide receiver set with a tight end, I think it's just the size, speed, agility, and pass catching ability of tight ends, along with some ability to still block and be an extension of the line. I think that has opened up playbooks for offensive coordinators tremendously. It's just given them that extra threat that defensive coordinators have to think about. You know, and it just the amount of route progressions that you can do now with a tight end like a Travis Kelce, or that, you know, you could do with, you know, like Tom Brady had with Gronkowski. I mean, those big, strong, you know, it basically they're like big giant wide receivers, right? And with almost the same speed, right? Like not they're not that much slower than, you know, like Kittle, you know, is not that much slower. Travis Kelce's not that much slower than, you know, a solid, you know, B to B plus or A minus wide receiver. Of course you get into the speed demons, you know, like the Tyreek Hills and whatever. Of course they're going to have a, just a speed that's off the charts. So anyway, that was a long answer to a short question. I think it's tight end, the evolution of the tight end game, and the evolution of the defensive tackle. Because when you look at what defensive tackles can do these days in disrupting the middle, I mean, you got guys that are 6'3", 6'4", Chris Jones, you know, perfect example, 310 pounds. Some of these guys are, you know, human wrecking balls at 350 pounds, right? Think about this kid that the Eagles, you know, drafted from Georgia, right? They're human wrecking balls, but they're running like 4.6 40s. Like, what the hell? How does that happen?
Right?
So the speed combined with the size, how do you single block a guy like that? Right? How does an offensive guard block, you know, Chris Jones by himself? You don't. So now it's forced the offenses to double team, run more zone, stay pretty much away from the middle of the field. Yep. Right? If you really think, when's the last time, you know, you really saw an NFL team gash you up the middle, right? Everything's happening off tackle. It's happening now with the RPO. And I think offenses have developed because of the defensive tackle and the inability to block them one-on-one, because it frees up linebackers, right, to make plays. And if you've got two big defensive tackles in there who can clog up the middle and can pass rush, it just throws your offensive game plan into a tailspin. So I think those two, for each side of the ball, I think those two things have probably developed more than anything, you know, because pretty much Caleb, everything else, D-backs look just like D-backs when I played, other than the pads being a lot smaller. Right? I mean, Albert Lewis used to wear like offensive lineman pads. Kevin Ross and, you know, those guys. But like, other than that, I mean, you know, a D-back's D-back today as they were in the 80s, 90s, 2000s. I mean, you know, wide receivers look pretty much the same. You know, I mean, J.J. Burden looks pretty much like every small, fast wide receiver that's on an NFL roster.
Mm-hmm. How many times have I said that, Caleb, that I think he would transition into this era so easily because of his speed and his size?
It'd be no problem for him. And then you can do it. Like, I don't want to waste your time, but like, I could go position by position, linebacker, defensive back.
That's what you're saying.
Right. You know, the other thing I think that's changed too, Cal, now that I'm thinking about it, and I don't think it's because of anything that's developed, is the lack of a fullback game.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you just don't, for whatever reason, teams just moved away from, you know, what we would call like an ISO fullback game, where, you know, you had, you know, a two back set and then you would leave the linebacker isolated with nobody on him. And then you would just run a fullback right at him, and then hope that your tailback could make a cut off of that block. That kind of game just went away. The lack of fullback, and obviously the Chiefs are seeing that this year with having no fullbacks on the roster at this point. It'll be interesting to see if they continue to go down. But you just don't see a fullback game anymore either.
Because I remember, and I mean, interrupt you. I mean, I remember kind of watching football throughout the years, and that's kind of the one thing, there's no fullback, but to kind of see the progression going from that hard nose grind offense to like the spread with all these different things. I mean, no wonder a JJ Burke can come in and do well, because it fits the skill set. I think that's one of the things that you're saying with Andy Reid's done a good job, is just making sure, let's get the player that's going to fit the system. We're not going to draft the person just because, oh, they're in the next big thing. Do they fit the system?
Right.
And that's kind of one thing, because I mean, with Kelce, like you're saying, I mean, he can do all those things and he can block. I mean, you probably saw the national pundits for a while were saying that Kelce wasn't great because he couldn't block him. He's shown he can knock over a Von Miller, or just all these different things. So it just kind of shows you kind of over time, what not subtraction, but kind of going away from certain positions, but also altering and changing some things. It kind of shows just kind of how the game has changed from multiple different areas. Because that, we're seeing obviously scoring is up, but it's interesting to see the chess matches between the offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator. You can do one thing one week, but the next week it may get you, have to change it up. So, I mean, it's great to see how not one answer works as a whole, but you can find different pieces that can help, plus a little bit of luck too.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. And nobody, and you know, I think there's some safety issues too with the old fullback ISO game. You know, people don't want to be having guys run into guys, you know, at 30 miles an hour, you know, 6, 7, 10, 20 plays a game. It's just, I think the game is much safer this way. And I think it's actually more exciting. I really do. Yeah. I think it's more exciting for the fans. I mean, look, everybody always goes back to the old school, you know, 6 yards and a cloud of dust and, you know, football and all, but I really love the way that the game has developed. I think it's a lot more exciting for fans. I think it's more exciting for players. It allows you to showcase some talent. And, you know, if you're going to be, you know, if you're going to spend, you know, between tailgating and post tailgating and the game, you know, if you're going to spend 6 or 7 or 8 hours invested in a day, you know, who wants to watch, you know, a team run the ball up the middle 30 times a game? Right. I mean,
God, that's what we lived with, Joe. I mean, Marty would run on fourth down. He didn't care. I mean, he just, until Joe came, Marty didn't care about passing the ball. I mean, he just, that was not something that he wanted to do. He didn't believe in it as much as other teams did. And we watched it day in and day out for all those years until Joe came. And then he didn't have a choice. I think it was in Joe's contract. Look, you got to let me pass. It's kind of those things. This is my game. So you got to let me do it. But it was such a different, and what you said about defensive tackles, now you notice like guys like Chris Jones, they're moving them around. Yeah. So you'll see Chris Jones in the middle, and then all of a sudden he's playing edge.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the matchup's there. Mm-hmm. And they see something that, okay, well, this is a good matchup. Let's go spill this route and let's flip-flop. And it's so much different. You didn't see that much versatility in players back in those days. As, you know, I mean, you were kind of an anomaly because you played, you know, versatile player, but a lot of guys weren't back in those days. I mean, they just, whatever their position was, is what they played.
Yeah.
And that's just, you know.
Yeah. I think Caleb, you hit on it best when you said it's become a chess match, you know.
Yeah.
I think back in the day, you know, football was a game where, like, while we did watch a lot of film and we did, you know, our study and we tried to match up as best we could against other teams, you pretty much had an offensive game plan. And, you know, and you hope that the defense didn't have the right game plan to stop you, right? I think to use your analogy again of like a chess match, like, I think back then coaches were only thinking maybe one move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're thinking, all right, if they're going to line up in this formation, they're probably going to do this. So let's put this defense. And then it kind of ended there. I think with the minds of some of these offensive and defensive coordinators and the way that they've grown up with the game, it's like they're thinking like 5 moves ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it's like they're thinking like, all right, let's think about what we're going to run, not just this series or this series, but that series, you know, in the middle of the second quarter as we put in this personnel and we try to pull out this play out of the playbook. I just think the chess match, and I love that, Caleb, that's a great – It has become a chess match. Football has become a chess match, which I think is really exciting for fans, you know, to watch the coaches kind of battle mentally on the sidelines.
Yeah.
Well, you know, about, like you said, JP, trying to get the right matchup on the field.
Well, I think that has actually made the left tackle position more, or the right tackle position more relevant and more on the same level of the left tackle, because you're having your best defensive edge rushers not just line up on the left tackle anymore.
Yep.
You've got your guys that you're saying, look, for the offensive line to win, I need all five of you to successfully block your man. For the defensive line to win, I need one guy to get through.
Yep.
And so all you're searching for is now it's a matchup-based game. It's why we're seeing offenses, wide receivers. You know, it used to be if you're the Jerry Rice of the world, if you're, you know, the Calvin Johnson of the world, you're on the outside. That's it. End of story. You're one-on-one with this corner all day. Now we're seeing, you know, the best offenses in the league are putting their wide receivers in the X, the slot. They're lining them all over the place. So I think it's just becoming, and we're moving all of our players, because for one play to be successful, we just need one guy to make a move. And so you're, the best coaches put your players in the spot to be able to take advantage of that.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Quentin. And I think that's we were talking about that. Jeff Fedotin and I were talking about that on our Believe in Chiefs podcast. And, you know, we were kind of mentioning how, you know, that same sort of philosophy that teams are throwing out there is that, you know, because I know there's that controversy right now with the Chiefs, right? Who's going to play left? Who's going to play right? I don't think Patrick really cares. I mean, Patrick, and again, the way that the quarterback position has developed, that, you know, Patrick almost to a certain degree, I feel, and this is my own personal opinion, you guys can certainly differ on it. I feel like Patrick gets pressured, not gets pressured more. I'm sorry, he gets flustered more by pass rushes that come from his right than come from his left.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I think it throws him more – if the right tackle is getting dominated, I think it throws him off more than if the than he's worried about some blindside, you know, hit from the backside. Mm-hmm. First of all, the guy's got eyes in the back of his head, so it's not even – it's irrelevant. But because he just has a sixth sense about where players are on the field. But I do mean that I think he would rather his right tackle be stronger. Because he is always, you always see him kind of drifting a little bit to his right, because that's just where he likes to go. And he likes to kind of creep up into the pocket onto his right side or the right side of the line. And I think it's actually more important that with Patrick Mahomes that your right tackle doesn't struggle. Because you've always seen, like, when Andrew Wiley had struggled, right, when he was learning the right tackle
position. Yeah.
It was always more of an issue than when Orlando Brown was having issues on the left, because, you know, other than the ankle injury when he got attacked from the backside, but that was kind of a freak thing. It's a great point. It's totally changed the game. It's changed the way, you know, where you position players and just like almost like everybody on the field has to be equal at this point.
You bring up a great point, because Wiley did struggle a lot up until really the Super Bowl. I mean, he was responsible for the most pressures, the most sacks on Mahomes out of the 26 sacks that that he had. I believe he was responsible solo for 9 of them. And then he was a part of 13 total, and the pressure rate, it was just way up there. Now, Orlando Brown had his own pressure rate, but he only allowed 4 sacks. Yeah. But that's because Mahomes is elusive enough to be able to get out, and he also had McKinnon helping him block.
Yes.
And McKinnon, you know, he's the ultimate blocker as a running back. I mean, I don't know if I've seen one block as well as him in a long time, especially for a guy his size. Yeah. He's not a big guy, you know, but he's a hell of a blocker. I mean, he takes on the blocks. But I agree with you 100%. I mean, you can almost plug him an average to above average left tackle and it'd be okay. But the right tackle side, you really have to hone in on somebody that's going to be strong. And for everybody out there that wants to know, that's probably why they gave a right tackle $80 million. Yeah. I mean, if you really think about it, I mean, right tackles don't pull that kind of money, but he did. But I know he's a versatile player and I know he can play both sides, but again, that's a lot of money to pay somebody that's predominantly right tackle.
It was crazy because I don't think our roster, even as late as 1996 in my last season, I don't think our whole roster was making $80 million.
The revenue stream has gone up and up, and will go up even more.
It's insane to think about.
If you were a premier, I'm talking like if you were a premier offensive lineman back then in the early to mid 90s, I mean, those guys were making $900,000 a year.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
crazy how the, you know, not that that's not that's great money, but like, and I'm talking, that was the premier player, you know, where your average salary back then on the offensive line was probably, you know, $300,000 a year, which is crazy. That's what like practice squad players are making today. It's crazy.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got guys on our team right now that are, I think the lowest paid player on our team is $750,000.
Yeah. That's so wild.
I mean, it's cable contracts, TV contracts, how the NFL has become the new America's pastime. The NFL season never really stops. Even now, when, you know, now we're talking about mini camps and all that stuff, it just seems like there's always something going on. So
the draft, the combine is on 24/7 on the NFL Network. You know, they're, you know, it's just one thing after another now that, which is great. I think it's awesome.
It's great. Yeah. Especially when the Royals suck.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. The Royals have been pretty bad,
but this is a positive podcast. So I have one sort of technical question for you. We talk about how the offensive line needs time to gel and, you know, Kansas City, this is sort of the second rebuilding of the offensive line during the Mahomes era. So can you just explain, you know, when we say the offensive line to gel, could you just go through what that means? And then how long do you think it really takes for an offensive line to work together? Is it one training camp? Is it through a couple of games through the season? Is it a whole season? So what are your thoughts on that?
That's a good question. Well, number one, I have a tagline, and I believe Tony Romo stole this line from me because I swear I was the first one that said this. I said that September is the new training camp. And he pulled that line out during a broadcast. So I'm like, God, if I just would have like trademarked that or something. But
well, Tony's going to steal it. That's just Tony.
Yeah. So. Those Cowboys. So I think it takes games. I don't think training camp is physical enough these days, and I don't think there's enough hitting, Quentin, for a line to gel at training camp. I really don't. I don't think they do enough contact in full pads to really get it. It takes that, what I call the new training camp, which is the first 3 to 4 games before a line is really gelling. And here's why. I mentioned earlier that there's a lot of double teaming that goes on these days, right? And especially in the run game. So let's take a look at the run game first. In the run game, everything is a zone block, right? Everything is a double team. It's either the tackle and the guard working together on the outside, or it's the center and guard working together on the inside. And when you want to double team a player, like I want you to imagine, let's picture the center and the guard and the linebacker behind a defensive tackle. Okay. So picture that there's 4 guys and somehow you've got those two guys have to block those 2 guys. Okay. So when the guard and the center go to block the defensive tackle, they actually literally have to get their hips together. And I coached offensive line for 11 years at the high school level. And this was a drill that Alex Gibbs, who was my offensive line coach, taught us, is I would stick a body pad between the guard and the center. And I would stick it in there as they were coming together. And if that pad fell on the ground, it meant they weren't getting their hips together close enough. I mean, that's how close you have to get your hips together to double team a defensive tackle in today's world. Okay.
Wow.
And so what you want to do is you want to get your hips together and make a wall of 600 pounds of dude, right? So like, because that's the only way you're blocking that 350-pound defensive tackle that runs a 4.6. And so when you get your hips together and you start pressing that guy, okay, now – okay, who's going to come off on the linebacker? Okay, if the linebacker goes over the top and scrapes over the top, it's probably going to be the guard that comes off, and then the center is going to overtake the defensive tackle. If the linebacker shoots inside, then the center is probably going to come off, and the guard is going to stay on the defensive tackle. Can you picture that in your mind's eye?
Yeah.
So if you don't rep that and get that muscle memory time and time again in live reps, you can't simulate it. You can't emulate it with no pads on. You just can't. Mm-hmm. And it just takes repetition, repetition, repetition. And I think that's why it takes offensive lines a while to gel. And then think about it. So now you've been – think about that blocking scheme, right? You've been practicing and practicing, practicing, and you know, and all of a sudden your right guard gets hurt. And now you got to bring in a right guard who you haven't been repping with. Bam, it throws everything into a tizzy, right? Because now you got to get that repetition again together and that and that. And it's no different in the passing game when you're trying to pass off stunts. So, like, picture a guard and a tackle, okay? This hand is the guard and this one's the tackle. And they're blocking two guys, right? A defensive tackle and a defensive end who are rushing up the field. Well, those, you know, a lot of times they run stunts, right? So the defensive end will shoot inside and the tackle will loop outside. Well, you've got to learn to pass each other off, right? So if I'm blocking the defensive tackle, I have to pass him to you. And then now the tackle has to ram in and take that guy while the guard takes the end that loops inside. Until you were on the same level, and if you get off on a level, you're going to get split in pass protection. So something for your listeners to like watch for, you know, as they're watching games, is watch those. Anytime you see a double team, see if they're able to maintain that hip connection where there's a smooth transition of going to the next level and being able to block the other player that you're double teaming with your buddy. So I don't know if that helped or hurt or gave you some insight into it, but that's why it's so important. And that's just one example of some offensive line play that happens between, you know, a guard and a center on run plays and a tackle and a guard on pass plays. Don't forget there's, you know, 20 other blocking schemes that you have to run, traps and, you know, pulls and different things. So it just, it's the only, you know, it's the only group on the field where you've got five guys and sometimes six, if you count your tight end, and sometimes seven, if you're working with a back in pass protection, that have to work together in one fluid motion. And it's the only thing. Like, everything else is one-on-one, right? I mean, everything else is, you know, coverage and different things like that. You got to get five to seven guys working together in conjunction. And that's why it's so difficult to gel. And that's why it's so hard when you have a couple of holes in your offensive line that it can just throw everything out the window and really create a lot. Just think back to the Super Bowl loss.
Yeah.
Yep.
I prefer not.
I prefer not to either, because it was really a lot of that game fell on the shoulders of the offensive line play, or lack of offensive line play. Yeah. And that was a perfect example of, you know, missing pieces and how an offensive line not gelling and why it takes so long for it to gel and how it can fall apart really quickly.
And two things you brought up, I mean, especially with the Super Bowl, I mean, you're talking about your first group is out completely. We lost Jeff Fisher in the last game of the playoffs, AFC Championship game. Then you're down to basically your third and fourth string linemen. I mean, that was a rough ride for those poor guys, because they really didn't know what they were doing out there. They had a really hard time. Again, they didn't gel. They didn't have time to gel. And then, of course, you know, when that happens, and it seems like it, which you haven't seen out of the Mahomes era yet, where he gets defeated. You know, he feels defeated. But by halftime, he felt defeated because people were dropping the balls. I mean, he was, guys, vertical, and he's throwing a pass.
Greatest incomplete pass in Super Bowl history.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he just throws an amazing pass, and it's dropped. And, you know, that would have never happened in the past. Yeah. You know, you had Chris Conley out there making catches in the 2018-19 season that were phenomenal, because he figured out where Mahomes was going to be. Mahomes would make his eye movement, his foot movement, or whatever it is to put a guy in a position. And they knew how to get open. Well, it just broke the entire team down at that point. It was kind of like how the 93 season went. You know, when Montana got knocked out that day, I mean, that was like a balloon deflated.
Yeah.
Hell, we were there. I mean, we saw it. It was it was the worst day in Buffalo, my only time in Buffalo, and I hated it. I was just miserable that day. But it was just, you can feel that difference. But what you said about training camp and even OTAs, especially training camp, back in the day, these guys don't realize it because they didn't see it a whole lot. And I tell them all the time. I mean, it was two different teams on the field. You had the offense and you had the defense. Even though you played for the same team, there was fights out there that I just stood back and went, why the hell are they beating the hell out of each other? And I never understood it. You know, helmets go flying and people beating each other up. And it was part, and they were in pads and they were really They're simulating a real game. And they don't do that as much now. In fact, if at all, I guess the last week of training camp they pad up, but it's still not the same as what you went through back in the day.
I went 13. We went 13. My rookie year, we went 13 days in a row of full pad two-a-days.
Yeah.
So
it was no joke. Yeah. And
I used to hug my toothbrush at night and cry and just lay there. If I weren't a rookie, I probably would have quit.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't easy back then. And I tell people all the time that ask me, because they knew I was around the game, and I'd say, man, I'm telling you, this is not the same game today as it was 30 years ago.
Yeah,
30 years ago, you saw helmets flying. You saw guys beating the hell out of each other. And then at the end of the day, they were, on game day, they were the best of friends. But
yeah, no, of course.
Not during practice.
Yeah, Caleb and Quentin, we walked to school uphill both ways. And
I think the argument that if and when the NFL adds that 18th game onto the schedule, that they need to add more padded practices back into the offseason, just because you are losing so much of that preseason time.
Yeah.
If you're really going to move, if you're going to lose another preseason game, you need to add some padded practices.
Yeah.
And I don't know this for a fact, but I have a thought that maybe some of this non-contact injury stuff we have is also due to a lack of just being on the football field. I don't have any evidence to back that up.
I feel the same way, buddy. I feel the same way. I don't think players are as conditioned to take hits and to take the sustained hitting that happens throughout the course of the season, because they don't really, their bodies don't get used to it from just beating each other up. I know that sounds really counterintuitive, but I think you're onto something. I mean, again, I don't have any data to back it up either, but I do feel the same way about that players today are not conditioned to take on the physicality of the game, because you just your body just would get used to it. Yeah, you were sore as hell when you were beating each other up for 13 padded two-a-days in a row at training camp up in River Falls, Wisconsin. We used to go on Wednesdays. We used to go play the lottery. We'd all go play the Powerball, and we would always hope and we would all be standing in line, and we'd all be saying how fast we would hand our playbooks in if we hit the I'll never forget Coach Schottenheimer. I think it was Coach Stock, who was our special teams coach. I'm pretty sure it was Coach Stock. They drove by one day and they were going to get lunch or something, and we were all up at Wednesday during our break. We only had like a limited time between practices, and everybody's standing in line at this like tobacco store in River Falls, Wisconsin. And he's like, what are these guys doing? Like, why are they not at the dorm sleeping? And why did everybody, what are you doing? Like, we fed you. What are you waiting for, lunch or something? And everybody's like, no, we're playing the lotto because we can't wait to win. And so we can walk out of camp. So that's how hard it was. That's how hard camp was. You're ready to give it up.
Yeah.
But it was definitely worth it once you broke camp and the Hunt family would have a big seafood festival for us. So that was always fun. I think I gained like 5 pounds that night.
You guys deserved everybody so great back then. I mean, well, they still do, but man, I remember it was insane to see some of the things that the lunches that they fed and this feast that everybody got, it was insane. I mean, you'd walk in there and it was like walking into a buffet in Vegas. It was just, everything was there for you. You had whatever you wanted. We were talking about this one day. I can't remember what team is it, Quentin? There are a few teams now that make you buy your own lunch.
The Cardinals during the off season, you have to pay for food.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean, I know the Eagles. I have a friend who's a dietitian with the Eagles, and man, they've got it good. Like, those guys don't cook anything. They have their own personal recipes for smoothies, and they have nutritionists always on site. They have chefs on site. They have cooks on site that they're constantly feeding them, and they have each player has their own diet. They all have their own, based on their metabolic measurables or whatever. Like, they get a certain smoothie that's like geared to them, like that has all the right ingredients based on their body composition and, their dietary restrictions and everything. It's pretty wild.
The only salary cap in the NFL is on your players and everywhere else you can get an advantage, whether that's spending more money on your coaching staff or more on your facilities, anywhere else you can get that advantage. I think that, you know, if you're an owner who truly just wants to win, then that's where you should be spending your money.
Totally. And also keep your players healthy. I mean, that's a huge thing. I mean, you see teams all the time that struggle with that. I mean, the Giants are one of those teams that struggle with their medical staff and how they, you know, they take care of their players. We saw it with Tony, for as a matter of fact. I mean, you know, the soft injury tissue, soft tissue injuries and everything that he went through. You know, he comes to Kansas City, has one injury, which was an ankle, and it was a tweak. Yeah. And then he had a muscle tightness, you know, a calf tightness. But he didn't have any more of those soft tissue injuries. And I think a lot of that has to do with how your team's medical staff is set up, what your design, how you're treating your players. If you want them to last and you want them to perform, you have to treat them right. You know, I think that's the one thing. I remember going into the locker room one time, and I don't know, I think it was pretty close to Thanksgiving. And you remember the big table in the middle of the locker, that great big giant table that sat there? It was full of everything, turkey, mashed potatoes. I mean, there must have been 8 turkeys sitting on this table and mashed potatoes and all this food. And I'm thinking, who the hell is going to eat all of this food? And I asked Derek, I said, what's this about? And he goes, we're going to eat that. And I said, why? You got a game. Yeah. And he goes, you know, I mean, you're supposed to eat all that before a game?
Yeah.
And he goes, it was about 5 hours before a game. And because it was I think it was a Sunday afternoon or Sunday night game. And he said, well, yeah. And I said, that's insane. How the hell are you going to be able to play? Yeah. And he said, oh, we'll be fine. Yeah. And I mean, I watched guys, Dan didn't stop eating. That man just ate. Insane.
Why would you there was a wonderful lady who used to throw me a bag of cookies going to the locker room at halftime. I'd always eat chocolate chip cookies at halftime. so we were going in the tunnel. So yeah, we weren't really thinking about our diet back then. We were just trying to bring calories into our bodies. Today it's so much more prescriptive and these guys are machines today. They're just human machines.
Yeah. It's insane to think about.
I got one last question.
Okay.
I think it's a softball.
Okay.
Who was the best trash talker either on your team or that you went up against?
Oh, no doubt, Chris Dolman.
That's immediate.
we were playing him on Sunday Night Football, and I was playing and I played the whole game against him, and I'll never forget, after he got me for his first sack, you know, he asked me, he said, hey, Joe, he goes, he was from York, Pennsylvania. So, and he went to Pitt. So he knew the area, and he goes, you went to Penn, right? Not Penn State. And I said, yeah, Chris. And this is on the field after he beat me for a sack. He goes, well, I guess all your frat buddies back at Penn are saying you went to Penn State now.
Wow.
It gets better. And you know, this, now I gotta remember, this is back in this was like 92, right? So like you know, there wasn't a whole lot of like televised games, right? You were lucky when you got on television, right? Yeah. We happened to be playing this game on ESPN, and he gets me for the second sack, and he says to me, he says, hey Joe, your parents have cable? It's not like brutally, like it's not like disgusting trash talk, but it was the kind of trash talk that just made you literally want to rip his helmet off, right?
Yeah. Yep, yeah. I can see that.
And my favorite thing, it wasn't me trash talking, but I'll never forget. We were playing the Raiders, and they were beating us by like 3 touchdowns. And I was in that game. I started the game at center. And then on third downs, I would go play. We had a ton of injuries. Grunny was out, and I started the game at center. And on third downs and passing situations, I would go out and play right tackle. That's how damaged we were. Oof. So I'm going against Howie Long the whole game in pass sets, and it was we were down by like 3 scores. We were throwing the ball every play, which we weren't great at in 1992 anyway. I mean, Dave was a fantastic quarterback, Craig, but like he wasn't a gunslinger. And so at one point Howie, I was literally like, at one point I drug him down by his belt. At one point I tackled him. I horse collared him. I grabbed him by his wrist and drug him to the ground. And referees didn't call anything because I think the referees wanted to go home and have dinner because they knew this game was over. Mm-hmm. So Howie never complained. Like, Howie was the kind of player, he was uber professional, right? But I think he got really frustrated on one play where I like literally tackled him. And so he goes up to the umpire and he says, "Mr. Official," he said, "73 held me on that play and got away with it." I walked up between him and the official and I said, "Hey guys, listen, with all due respect, I'm holding Howie on every play and getting away with it." And I walked back to the house.
There we go.
So, you know, it was fun to have those conversations out on the field, and they happen. Like, you know, you hear now it's easier today with the directional mics and, you know, the sound bites, and everybody's got the mic. They're all mic'd up and everything. But yeah, it was fun. It was fun to get to know players and trash talk a little bit. And, I'd say that the Chiefs trash talker, I'd say probably was Dale Carter.
Yeah, Dale was a mouth. Dale loved to talk. Yeah.
He was probably the one that I remember, you know, he was always yammering at somebody about something, offense, defense, didn't matter, special teams. He was giving somebody, trying to get them out of their game. Yeah. But he was damn good at it, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, he was. He was. He would jack with the water boy. He didn't care. He would trash talk everybody.
Yeah.
He was a funny guy though. I liked him a lot. He was a nice guy. But yeah, that's funny you say that. I was thinking that's a good question, Quentin, because I was kind of wondering who he would say. Because I mean, I've heard guys like JJ would always talk about like,
said Dion, I think.
Yeah, Dion was a big mouth. You know, all these guys that he played against, you know, were big trash talkers. But we heard a lot of John Randall, you know, and
he was. Like we practiced against them every year. We would go up and we would go to Mankato, Minnesota, and we would scrimmage against them for 2-3 days at a time. And it was a nightmare to have to go against those guys like for 2 or 3 days because their motors were him and between Chris Dolman and John Randall, they were. You know, and Keith Millard, I mean, those guys, they had a fantastic defensive line. So nobody was taking any plays off. So you couldn't even brother-in-law with anybody, which was you know, always nice. You could do with your own guys. Like, hey, you know, I'd say to Neil Smith, "Hey, Neil, my right shoulder really hurts today. You make me look good, I'll make you look good." You know, you could kind of just scrap it up. But when you're going against fresh guys, you know, and they're all trying to make the team, it's like there's no brother-in-law going on.
Yeah. So, awesome. Yeah. That's good times. Well, what do you think of this Patrick Mahomes situation? What do you think of this team, man?
I love this team. I love that they have a chip on their shoulder. I love that they seem to, you know, right now this offseason, obviously most of the prognosticators and the betting lines and things have them looking at as the sort of the class of the AFC, but I like that there's doubters, even though they've had the success. I think it motivates this team to prove something every time they're out there. Not that they ever were. They're all uber professional, and I think they all have the intrinsic motivation to be successful. But I do like that added extra chip. I love that like teams like the Bengals right now just can't get their feet out of their mouths. You know, just as far as like everywhere they turn. You know, it's another, you know, knock on the Chiefs and we're better than you in this way and that way. And go ahead, you know, keep saying it. It's just more bulletin board fodder, more Twitter fodder to motivate the Chiefs. So I love it. I love that they're going into this as almost like, you know, Super Bowl underdogs, which is fine by me.
Well, they play so much better, it seems like, when they are doubted and they are the underdog. I mean, and you're right. The Bengals just can't stop. Their players can't stop. Their mayor can't stop. Nobody can stop.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of insane to think about how.
I think the Bills have learned their lesson. I think the Bills have kind of kept quiet.
Yeah, it only took us 13 seconds.
They're not going to be jawing anymore about the Chiefs. I think it seems like the target's coming from the Bengals. You've got the Chiefs. The Bengals, the Bills, you know, I mean, I got to tell you, I think the Jets might pull a little something, you know, this year. They've been quiet, not quiet, but they've quietly succeeded in the draft.
Thank you, Joe.
You know, they've gotten, you know, Aaron Rodgers now. I, I, I think, but I'll tell you, once you get past like the Ravens, mm-hmm. the Bills, the Bengals, and the Jets, holy cow, I think the AFC just falls off a cliff.
Yeah.
So, and I think the NFC is not much different. You know, you got the 49ers, the Eagles, you know, the Cowboys, and then, you know, then you see some everybody big props there too.
Yeah.
So I think this is going to be, this season is going to be a season where you're going to see a lot of mediocre football happening at a certain level, but you're going to see some majorly high level football happening at the top level. And boy, did the NFL know what they were doing with this schedule, right? With the Chiefs playing the Eagles, the Bengals, and the Bills all in one season. I mean, that's insane. So I think, plus you got, you know, and they got to run the gauntlet through the AFC West. So, you know, I think it's going to be a really good season for everybody. I think fans have a lot to look forward to for sure.
You know, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. No matter how bad the AFC West is, it's always been difficult because it's a divisional rival. I understand we play everybody twice a year and all that, but it just seems like no matter how bad a team is, I mean, the Raiders have come close a couple of times. I mean, the Chargers have always been tough for us. So it's weird how that plays out. And I know that people think that they know our tendencies and things of that nature, but they really don't. Yeah. I mean, because especially with Andy Reid, he's always got something different up his sleeve. And when you've got Mahomes, everything's different. Now you've got a group of second-year guys that came. I mean, they came in 11th overall in defense. Yeah. Who would have ever thought that, you know, when we had some of the stars that we had 2 years ago that couldn't break 27th overall?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think it's just it's one of those seasons that it's a make or break for the Chiefs in a lot of ways because they did bring in some new talent. They've got more talent that they're bringing in. There's a lot of guys that were doubted in the draft, like Rashee Rice. Everybody was upset about that. I like him. I think he's going to be a surprising player for a lot of people. And I think Tony is too. You know, I think Tony, this is probably going to be Tony's breakout year. I think he's going to really show some people some things. So anyway, I just wanted your thoughts on what you thought about this new group of, this new era of the Chiefs. I mean, it's so different than it was even 7 years ago or 8 years ago, you know, with Andy Reid's group.
Yeah.
Alex Smith is a great guy. He's just one of those guys that couldn't get you over the hump right there, you know. But, man, Mahomes takes chances, those Brett Favre chances, but doesn't have nearly the interceptions or the mistakes. And it's pretty insane to see somebody play as well as he does.
Special.
He really is. So I've never seen a quarterback in my life throw a curveball with a football, and he can do it. So, and he can also throw a slider with it, and that's pretty insane. I mean, I don't know if that's normal. And I don't know how his arm can take it, to be honest with you, as hard as he throws a football, but he just does it. It's crazy to think how good he is.
Yeah.
I don't know, Joe. We've taken up a lot of your time,
this
man.
This has been awesome, guys. I appreciate it. Let's do it again. You know,
hey, man, anytime. Yeah, anytime.
This was a lot of fun.
You want to come on. Yeah, definitely.
I got more stories in the Arsenal shootout.
Oh, man. Awesome. Yeah, that's for sure. We could go on for 5 hours like that.
Questions.
Yeah,
Quentin, I love it. Well, you know, if coming out of that beard of knowledge, definitely.
Yeah,
there we go.
For the record, I did not come up with that nickname. It was given to me because when I first started on the show, I was like, and through the season, I was like statistics. That's what I just did as I was coming up with statistics. And then the second part of my name, which I won't even read it, is because I don't think that the Ross brothers are going to make an impact in the wide receiver room.
Neither one of them.
And
he
that
doesn't
just
even think Justin Ross
off.
Is going to make an impact.
So that part, that part of the name was also given to me without my permission. One day it was just thrown on there, and I didn't
notice. I did it in the middle of the show, Joe.
Yeah, I didn't notice it until late in the show, and I was like, that's there now.
I love it. I love it.
Well, you got to have fun. Joe, question. Let's clear this up really quick. Just a quick question before we go, and this is for Quentin's sake. Now, if you're looking at a spread offense that we have, okay, and you understand, I mean, you know the game better than anybody. We're a true spread offense. We can hit 10 guys in one game, okay? I mean, it doesn't matter who it may be. If you have a player that steps onto the field, no matter if it's week one, week 17, in the playoffs or the Super Bowl, if that certain player is an impactful player to help us win a Super Bowl, win a playoff game, win a regular season game, Is he still an impactful player? Even though he may not do much during the season, he just happens to have three or four great games, good games, helps us, you know, makes a, you know, game-winning touchdown, whatever the case may be. Is he an impactful player, or is he just a, you know, just this guy that may not make an impact at all? How would you look at that?
I think that's the beauty of this team. I think that's the beauty of what really great teams are, is they find the right time for players to be impactful. And I think that's what makes this magic for the Chiefs. I think, you know, to a certain degree, you know, and I can say this because they're in the NFC and we actually won in the Super Bowl, and we won't see each other again until next year. But I think the Eagles have done very similar things. It wasn't always one guy, you know, for the Eagles. It's not always one guy for the Chiefs. I mean, yeah, the way that Patrick goes, sometimes the team goes, but, you know, they've also been able to do things without Patrick at times too, right, where he hasn't been playing as well. And I think that's a testament to this team being a team. And I think that's what makes them really special, that you don't have to, you don't have week in and week out, like, you know, just because you're not doing it week in and week out doesn't mean you're not an amazing player and that you can't be an impactful player. McKinnon's, I think, a perfect example. I was so disappointed to think that they might not keep him. And because I think, and everybody said, well, he's not really an impact player. I'm like, yes, he is. He's an impact player, but he doesn't have the stats of a Derrick Henry or, you know, some unbelievable, you know, running back that, you know, gets all pro honors, but he fits this offense perfectly. And he fits it when he needs to fit it. And he fits it when Andy Reid needs him to fit it. So no, I'm with you that I think in an organization like this, everybody can be a star in this offense. It's just a matter of when your number gets called.
Thank you very much. I needed to hear that. That was just a little validation.
If you're the receiving option on this roster, and you get, if you end the season with 130 yards, I just don't know if I can say that you've been an impactful player. I mean,
But it depends on the play. It depends on the play, Quinn. It depends on when it happens. I mean,
exactly.
You know, I think about, you know, like that punt return in the Super Bowl, right? Like, who would have thought, right? We were struggling. And that one, you know, that was almost like a game changer, you know, that one play. I think you'd have to look at the plays that they're making too. I do agree with you, Quinn. It's not, you know, but if you had those kind of stats, but they were 130 yards that meant something at the right time. When they were needed, it's kind of like, really, if you think about it, defensively, sacks are that way, right? You can go, players can go games without a sack. Man, you make the right sack at the right time,
yeah,
and you force a fumble on, you know, third and long when you need to get the ball back and you strip the ball out of the quarterback's hand. You might not do anything for the rest of the season, but that's an impactful play, which in turn kind of makes you an impactful player. You could split words and kind of.
Yeah, I just if you're the eighth receiving option on this team, and like we're having it. Chiefs fans do this thing where every offseason we seem to like gravitate towards one player that's the next coming of, you know, pick your superstar player, and then they don't end up doing anything. And I just feel like that's the hype we're building up for either Ross. And so I'm just not falling into it. I'm not doing it. He's going to have to prove, a guy that has significant injury history his entire career, you know, hasn't done anything since he played at Clemson. And so he has to prove it to me. I'm not giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, that's the fans doing it, right? I mean, the Chiefs haven't said anything about it yet. They're going
to. Their Twitter videos are saying everything.
Yeah, they love him. I mean, Mahomes has had nothing but good things to say about him as well.
Better look good in shorts and a T-shirt. That's my other thing. I'm tired of people showing me these videos of Ross jumping around in shorts and a T-shirt. And I'm like, you better be, because if you can't outrun a corner in shorts and a T-shirt, we got bigger problems.
Now I know why you added that extra moniker there.
Yeah.
Name. Hey, iron sharpens iron, buddy. So keep
that's exactly.
It. That's it. Absolutely, Joe.
Yeah, God, love the I love the differences of opinions and everything. But this has been great, guys. Thank you so much.
It has been. Joe, thanks for coming on. Anytime, please come back on. I mean,
yeah, we'd love to have you back on. It's a lot of fun.
Your insight's amazing.
Caleb, JP, great time. Great questions. A lot of fun. Really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Well, next time we'll talk about a lot of old time stuff. Stuff that went on back in the day.
That sounds good.
Right.
All right, guys.
We'll appreciate it, Joe.
Have a wonderful night. Thanks so much for having me on.
You too, man.
Thanks.
Have a great night. That was nice to have Joe on. And he validated my 130 yards.
He validated one of Quentin's points too. So
he did.
It was a tie.
But here's the thing. I mean, he's right. Here's what I look at the most. If those 130 yards are impactful in some way during a game that helps us win a game, they were an impactful player.
Yeah, if you end the year with 180 yards, but they were both 90-yard touchdown returns, sure. But I just don't think that that's going to happen. And so you can call me the doubter, or you can call me a realist, or you can tell me I'm right, you know, this time next year. Either way works.
Well, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens week 17, week 18, week 19, whatever it goes to, week 20, which I think that's what's going to happen anyway. But, it's crazy to think, you know, every time I talk to somebody that played in those days, it just brings back memories that I forget about. Things that I forget about that went on, you know.
Well, you know, there's so many of them just like tucked away that you gotta flash them up.
You do. It's
us
crazy.
Youngins, you know, here we don't got everything. That problem.
Hey man, I mean it was crazy times back in those days. I mean, like I said, those guys did, and Joe's right. I mean, players today don't do what they used to do in training camp. I mean, man, they beat the shit out of each other with helmets.
That's the reason why the NFLPA changed the rules, and why over the last couple of contract negotiations, it's been a lot about, you know, reducing the limit. You know, we talk – NBA has that problem right now, right, where we're talking about them limiting their play on the field, on the court. And so the NFL had already solved that problem with a lot of the off-season programming. But, yeah, I'd like to have Joe back on. There's a couple of things that I didn't get to, some more funny kind of questions and some other serious ones. I'm happy he took the time to answer some of my serious and funny questions. You know, at talking to people about their life experiences, especially in a world that I will never be a part of, I will never be a professional at. Shocker alert. I will never be a professional athlete. So in order to, unless like, I don't know, what's that Olympic sport they do where they like shove the rock across the ice and it's like,
oh, curling. You want to play bocce ball?
Curling.
Okay. Curling,
that still might be in my future. I haven't hit like my midlife crisis yet where, you know, me and my buddies decide to, you know, go throw some rocks on some ice yet. I haven't reached that point. So I won't close that door all the way.
Well, that's okay, Quentin. I mean, you talk a good game about football, and that's all that really matters. So as long as you know the game, what's the difference? I mean, honestly. We really appreciate Joe for coming on. Again, this show was sponsored by Foco Sports. Make sure you go on and check out all of their licensed NFL gear. If you have any questions, comments, anything, please like and subscribe. And we will get back to you on the comments as soon as we can. We will talk to you again Thursday. And we'll have a whole different show. Quentin's got a whole lineup set up for us. So
I do. Yeah, that'll be fun.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. And we may have somebody on. And he may enjoy the lineup that you have. So we're going to work on that. I'm going to talk to you guys about it and see what you think. But with that being said, we appreciate everybody for coming and listening to us rant. And we appreciate Joe for being on. We will talk to you guys again on Thursday. Peace out, everybody.